Well, welcome to another episode of the Leadership Enigma, and I'm always excited when guests come back. I'm always excited because there's normally a reason why guests want to come back as well, and that's because in some ways they have enhanced or created a whole new perspective or new point of view on leadership. And my next guest, a returner, is Adam Kingle, who's a great friend and a colleague and a global educator, and he's just written his new book, Sparking Success. And really the exam question I think we need to set for this episode is, how do we make creativity and leadership as simple as possible? There you go, Adam. I'm setting us up for great success. Come back to me just after this break. This is all about sparking success, creativity and leadership. Hi, I'm Adam Pacifico, and welcome to the Leadership Enigma, a world-ranked, award-winning podcast that's insatiably curious as regards what leaders do, how they do it, and importantly, why. We'll delve into the human doing, but even deeper into the human being and the power of human-centered leadership to drive sustainable change. So whether you're an entrepreneur, business owner, corporate executive, each week we speak to global experts, academics, rising stars, ambitious upstarts and disruptors, as together we will discover that success leaves clues. Adam, welcome back to the Leadership Enigma. How are you, sir?
I'm well. Thanks for having me back.
It is hot outside, but not in the studio. And this is the new studio. You've been here before, but this is the new studio. May I ask your thoughts?
I love Studio 2.0. It's very swish.
It's pretty good, isn't it? Well, yeah. And also that makes James happy too, when we hear that. Let me start by getting a little bit of background about you, because people may have listened to you on a previous episode, but just tell us a little bit about your background, especially within the realms of leadership, and then let me come on to the book.
Yeah, almost everything I do either is directly or peripherally around leadership. I'm an author, an educator, a keynote speaker, and a consultant.
You've written loads of books, haven't you?
This is my second book, but I've written a lot of articles.
Oh, okay, fine. Well, you've written one more book than me, let me tell you. Okay, and why has leadership always been such a focus for you? Where's that coming from?
Well, I think so many of the ways in which we hope leaders create relationships that spark growth or engagement just have to do with how they project their leadership. And so almost everything, I think, comes back to leadership, whether you're talking about culture, growth, business development, OD, you name it.
This is a really important subject, isn't it? Because I had a couple of great guests in earlier, Darren and Ati from Business 4.0. And they were talking about, and we've seen this in the Endelman Trust Barometer, that actually businesses now are trusted more than governments in relation to being a force for good. So by that, the leaders and the leadership in these businesses have really got a weight of expectation now, haven't they?
Yeah.
So are you seeing that in your work, that the expectation of leadership and businesses generally now has been raised as a priority?
It has. And I think part of that is that finally we're entering the fourth industrial revolution. I think finally we're throwing off the shackles of the industrial revolution.
Okay.
I think it's kind of funny that technology has evolved exponentially over the last 150 years. How we communicate, our concern about stakeholders and society and et cetera. But management and leadership, I think, has been fairly stagnant. I know that's a pretty damning thing for me to say.
It's very traditional.
It
Can
is
I
very
say
traditional.
That? Was that fair?
No, I think it is fair. I honestly believe if we were able to resurrect a CEO from 1860 and have them sit in a CEO's office today,
yes,
they may not recognize the technology, but if they listen to what the CEO was saying, how they conduct meetings, what they prioritize, they would find it very familiar.
You know, that would be very cool, wouldn't it? If I actually got kind of the old school, new school CEOs together. And actually, no good would come from that, can it? But let's be honest. So you're also seeing then this rising up the priority list.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we finally are recognizing that leadership is due for a revolution. Part of the reason that it hasn't, I think, is leadership for too many decades has looked back rather than forward.
Right.
I think when I remember the 80s and 90s and books on leadership, it was very much based on precedent in history. In other words, do you want to be a good leader? Jack Welch, if you think was a good leader. Here, read this biography of Jack Welch, and you too can be a great leader. And obviously we know that leadership can't be imitative, and we know that traditional or historical forms of leadership may not be valid for new challenges.
So leaders born or made?
Made.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I think we can be born with certain traits, can't
yeah.
we, which are intrinsically useful to the role of a leader.
Right.
But at the end of the day, leadership is incredibly hard and work in progress always. So I'm with you on that. Yeah. So I wanted to ask you that. Let me talk about your new book, because I know you're incredibly curious and you write very, very well. I've seen some of your articles on LinkedIn. So Sparking Success, Why Every Leader Needs to Develop a Creative Mindset. Why this book, Adam?
Yeah, well, let me take you back. An academic that I really respect once told me that the reason I do research is I see something in the world and it raises a question,
yep,
and I don't know the answer, nor can I find the answer. And if I'm curious enough about it, I'll dedicate some time and energy to figuring it out.
Okay.
And ultimately, I think that's what research is about, right? It's trying to fulfill, it's trying to scratch the curiosity itch.
Welcome to the Leadership Enigma.
There
you're
you
in
go,
the right,
right?
place.
For me, this itch began about 5 years ago,
okay,
when I saw two roughly simultaneous but completely independent pieces of survey results. One was done by Boston Consulting Group that was asking CEOs of top 200 global companies, what are your top three priorities? And creativity and innovation, or some variation thereof, appeared 79% of the time. So roughly 4 out of 5 CEOs around the world are saying creativity and innovation, top priority.
They're buzzwords, aren't they? All over the place.
Absolutely, right, yeah. I mean, there's no, essentially, that's telling us there is really nothing more important if you even everything out and see what is the topmost priority. At the same time, though, McKinsey did a study,
yes,
but not of the CEOs, of the rank and file.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
You can see where this is going.
Yeah, there's a compare and contrast,
yes,
coming.
And asked, how good is your organization at creativity and innovation? And 94%, Adam, said, we are crap at it.
Really?
We are terrible at it. And the first question I had to ask myself is there a larger gap in corporate life today between an aspiration and a reality?
Wow.
And that's why I started saying, well, what can leaders do to address that gap? Because, as we said before, I do believe it's a leadership challenge.
Yes.
And I believe that CEOs crying the importance of creative innovation are, to some extent, greenwashing the message. Because we also know, at least in the UK over the last 5 years, investment in creativity, innovation, R&D has gone down by 50%.
Interesting. So did you come to the conclusion that this was the standout biggest gap between,
yes,
aspiration and reality?
Yeah, I certainly have found nothing else. Let's put it that,
okay,
way.
And what's going on then with the aspiration is high and then the investment is negligible?
Yeah.
What is that all about? Is that just a complete lack of congruence in we must do X? Actually, no, when push comes, yeah, to shove, I don't want to spend dollars and pounds on
Yeah, it's partially that.
Yep.
But it's also that leading creativity and innovation requires practicing certain habits. I came to that conclusion more as I was researching the book.
Okay.
And we know that changing habits is bloody difficult. And asking particularly seasoned executives, leaders of teams, to change habits,
who may have certain ways of doing things,
who may have certain ways of doing things, is even harder.
Yeah.
You know, unfortunately, I think going back to some of the precedents of how we believe leadership is supposed to happen, for too often, I think we have relied on a metaphor for leadership as expertise. If you're the leader, you're supposed to have all the answers.
Yes.
You're supposed to already have the habits.
Which is a nonsense now.
Which is nonsense.
Let's be honest.
Yeah.
So did you find as well that when people and organizations, senior leaders, talk about creativity, that actually they didn't know what they were talking about?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So what's that about then? Is it just another word or phrase that comes into the leadership lingo and everyone,
yeah,
grabs it and says, yes, we need more creativity.
Yeah.
What does that mean? I don't know,
right,
but I want some.
Who is not for creativity and innovation at the end of the day, right?
It sounds cool.
It sounds cool, yeah.
But as you say, aspiration and reality, huge
vast
chasm. So why do you think there was such a focus on the desire for it? Do you think that there was a feeling that we're actually rubbish at it? And therefore we...
Possibly. But I think part of it also is that we know that in a VUCA world, you know, we have new challenges that we've never seen before. And we know that that requires an ever greater human capacity,
yep,
for adaptability, agility, inspiration, finding new solutions. All of these are functions of creativity. And so I think it's a business imperative, not just, it would be nice if we actually improved this in my own leadership act.
So just for anyone as well, I'm going to talk about VUCA, volatile, yeah, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous, just,
yeah,
for anyone to think, hang on, what's that phrase? Yeah. And it trips off the tongue for us, Adam,
it
doesn't it? We're used to it. And obviously, we can't use yesterday's logic for tomorrow's problems.
Yep.
And I think you've given me a lovely segue into the realm of neuroscience, because if we're talking about trying to change behaviors, We know that is fundamentally difficult. So talk to me about how are we creative and how neuroscience plays a part in that.
Yeah, well, I guess the footnote I would say before I get into neuroscience is that most of the book, Spark and Success, is about what the arts can teach us about the habits of leadership. But I thought before I delve into that, I had to look at the neuroscience of creativity. And if I didn't understand how the brain was triggered in terms of enhancing creativity, then none of the other habits or ways of behaving that I discovered in the arts, I wouldn't necessarily be able to make a correlation.
Adam, let me just ask you, because I know the answer to this question, but there's you've got a bit of a background that would lead you towards such a focus. So tell us a little bit, because some people might be thinking, well, hang on, why the focus on... Tell them
on the arts.
Yeah.
My very first career, way back many moons ago, I was a theater director. So my first career was in the arts. Yes. And I knew that the way in which people led teams, the way in which you rehearsed a cast, the way in which you had a management committee for any arts organization, there were conversations and ways of working that I have found markedly, significantly different. However, none of those habits or ways of working or ways of conversing, I think, need to be idiosyncratic to arts organizations. Gotcha. And so I was convinced that there must be ways in which we can import those habits into leaders in any industry.
So you're going back to those fond memories of life in the arts.
Yeah, so it was a very personal book, but I didn't want to just rely on my own experience. I wanted to see if some of these habits were broadly true and broadly practiced in the arts. And just to make sure that these weren't idiosyncratic, I then tried to find leaders in so-called traditional industries who were also doing these things.
Right.
So that the reader couldn't possibly go, that's fine. That would work in a theater.
We don't do it like this.
We
it
can't
apply.
Possibly do that.
And we hear that sometimes, don't we, Adam? Let's be honest. So let me come back to the neuroscience.
Yep.
So how comes that's played a part in the work that you've done, the research, and the book itself?
Well, I think it was really interesting. The first thing that I discovered that I think is perhaps the most significant is that the brain, we know, is the most energy-using organ in the body, right? Because it's filled with electrical impulses. You know, we say when we're trying to think hard, we sometimes say, I'm trying to make a connection between this idea and that. When we say make a connection, what that literally is an electrical impulse among neurons.
Okay.
That requires a lot of energy, if you think about it, right? Literally having electrical sparks.
I'm finding it more and more difficult, let me tell you, as I get older.
Well, the funny thing is, you know, we are teachers, right? I teach for a number of universities.
Yeah.
And, you know, particularly in executive education, where perhaps people haven't been in the classroom for a long time, at the end of a session or at the end of a week, what they often say is, I'm exhausted. But you think, well, you've been sitting on your butt.
Yeah.
You know, so why are you tired? It's because this energy-consuming organ has been firing on all cylinders.
Gotcha.
So yes, it's exhausting. You've actually used a lot of energy in forcing yourself to think about new things.
Right.
You know, we say human beings are by definition lazy, what we really mean is the brain would really like to find patterns that it already knows so that it doesn't have to create new neural connections, because that's not energy efficient.
And the world that we live in right now just won't allow us, let's be honest.
Yes. So when I was looking at these neural connections, what I discovered is that we have different possible brain states.
Okay.
That go, as you can imagine, which goes from deep sleep to high focus, intense concentration, making lots of new connections among existing ideas or creating whole new ideas.
Yep.
And each of those states are measured in hertz, right? Simply the frequency of the electrical brain waves going on in our heads. Well, at the topmost end, that's called gamma state. That's over 30 hertz. So what that means is you've got lots of electrical impulses going on. And generally, when people say I'm in a high state of focus, sometimes some scholars call that flow. For the practitioner, how do you know we're in flow? One symptom of flow is time seems to either speed up or speed down.
Right.
You know, like you're
call it in the zone.
You're in the zone, right? And you say, did 2 hours just pass? Really? Yeah. It feels like 20 minutes. You were probably in gamma state.
Right.
You were so focused, you weren't even aware of time. All the way down to deep sleep. Now, there's things in the middle. There's like theta, which is sort of light meditation, which is probably our brain state in a typical committee meeting.
Right.
But usually...
You heard it here first.
I'm going into theta now. But usually, I think we're in beta state. Beta is just kind of normal alertness. You know, here's the funny thing that I learned as I studied the neuroscience. our brain, for all the reasons I talked about before, through habit and preference, loves to stay in beta or even theta, right? Can we just be here, because then that's calm.
Is it like third gear?
You're putting no pressure on me. Exactly.
Cruising along.
Yeah, that's right. And so when you try to exercise your brain to get up into peak performance, peak creativity,
yes,
the brain, through habit and preference, tries to pull us back until we've exercised the muscle enough that the brain, like any other muscle in the body, goes, okay, all right, so this is going to be how we're going to do this every day, are we?
Okay.
Fine. So just like it. So think about if you're running a marathon.
Yeah.
You can't tomorrow run 26 miles.
No, I can't.
You can't. You have to gradually build up to it. So two interesting habits I learned from neuroscience is if you genuinely want to practice creativity, be good at it, and be in a creative state easier and for longer, you have to dedicate time to it regularly.
Yes.
And a sufficient amount of time. In other words, 5 minutes ain't going to do it. You have to train the brain to say, okay, can we do this for 30 minutes once a week, for example? And after a while, you'll find you can get to a creative state where you're coming up with new ideas easier and faster. You're not so exhausted at the end of the exercise. And over time, like a marathon, you can be in a high state of creative peak performance for an hour, for an hour and a half, for 2 hours, for 2.5 hours, like actors might be on stage in a West End performance.
So almost the stamina gets better.
Yeah,
staying
your creative
that,
stamina. I like that phrase very much.
Well, again, I feel I've now added value.
There you go.
To
boom. Mic drop.
So I know you focused on a number of areas which perhaps lend themselves to perhaps more of a creative state. I don't know. You'll tell me. I'm just going to focus on a few, and then we'll help people understand where they can get the book and how they can contact you. And one of the realms that you looked at was jazz.
Yeah.
Help me with that.
Well, so I wanted to look at lots of different creative media. Even though my historic medium is theater,
yes,
I didn't just want to focus on that, because I thought actually the reader would more easily dismiss it and go, well, theater, that's just theater. But the more different media I could find, I thought the more persuasive my argument could be. And also it was interesting to see that there were different habits in different artistic media that seemed to be more redolent. So from jazz, I think one of the most important things I learned, if I could quote jazz pianist great Thelonious Monk, there are no wrong notes. I love that phrase, right? And I think that's a really good metaphor for our historic fear of failure in organizations. We can't possibly try something and it not work.
Yes.
The problem with that is another thing I learned about creativity is it's a numbers game. You can't sit here and go, Adam, come up with the best idea you possibly can. You have 5 minutes. I only want to hear your best idea. You're not going to come up with the best possible idea, right? Much better to say, let's take 5 minutes to come up with 20 possible ideas without judging.
Yes.
And then we'll look at them and we'll see if we've got any winners here as we explore them.
Yeah.
As a further example of that from jazz, jazz legend Herbie Hancock, when he was early in his career, finally found himself playing next to the great Miles Davis.
Right.
And he was nervous as hell. And he thought, oh no, oh no, oh no. And he started playing, and what came out we thought were the wrong notes. And yet, to his amazement and surprise and delight, Miles Davis simply incorporated that melody that he just heard and built on it and created and continued the song. Afterward, Miles Davis said, again, like Thelonious Monk, there are no wrong notes. It's the notes you play afterward that make it right or wrong.
Okay.
You know, it's what you do with every suggestion. Much like I know you had Neil Malarkey on.
I was going to say, this now reminds you of improv.
It's similar to improv. It's the great lesson of the offer,
yeah,
and yes-anding the offer.
Right.
Right. There's no such thing as a bad offer. And so that was one thing, you know. And actually, this is a theme that came up across different artistic media. The idea that it's a complete myth that we can sit down and think of that one exponentially brilliant idea,
eureka
moment that strikes our brain, you know, from the thunderbolt from the hand of Zeus himself. It almost never happens.
No pressure.
Yeah. In fact, what most creative leaders told me, and I really tried to focus on highly successful creative leaders, said, all of our good ideas generally started as bad ideas, which as we explored it and developed it and thought, what if, and yes, and, it became a good idea.
Well, success from failure as well.
Yeah, that's right.
We see that in Silicon Valley, don't we?
Totally.
Didn't they call it Phoenix from the Ashes?
Phoenix from the Ashes.
Out of great adversity came what now we know as many of the unicorns that exist.
Yeah. And I think I'm sympathetic to that. I grew up in Silicon Valley, maybe before it was called Silicon Valley, but nevertheless, I think somehow it's embedded into my DNA. But with jazz, another thing that I learned that I think is also super important is that it got related to neuroscience.
Yes.
There are two parts of the brain, apparently from the jazz musician, that get shut down when they're performing. So again, neuroscientists study this.
Okay.
And the two parts of the brain that get shut down are the part of the brain that is self-judging and the part of the brain that says, I care what other people think. So self-judging and social judging.
Right.
And you've got to be that, right? In an improv group, you've got to shut those parts down. But actually what neuroscientists show is actually literally, physically, biochemically, that's what happens.
Wow.
So that you're in a complete state of acceptance and exploration. In most top teams, when I consult with them on creativity and innovation, and improving their capacity for creativity. However, what I generally find is the leader's typical response to new ideas is, well, this is why that won't work.
Right.
The classic yes, but. We know that yes, but actually just means no, sit down, shut up.
Right.
And that's because we think that the leader's job is to immediately judge and assess. The leader is expert. I know best. I'll take your idea, and I will immediately put it through the lens of...
Which is so restrictive, isn't it?
Which is so restrictive. And why should leaders decry that their people don't give them good ideas anymore if every response they give to a new idea is, well, this is why that idea won't work.
And then people will just stop.
And they'll just
stop
after
talking.
A while. Of course, because you've crushed their sense of self.
Yes.
And self-confidence. Now, here's the important thing. If you're a leader... and you want to encourage people to give you new ideas.
Yeah.
You don't have to execute the ideas. That's the problem. CEOs tell me, you know, I share this knowledge with them, and they go, yeah, but Adam, I can't do everything. That's, you know, some of these ideas are stupid. Some of these ideas are expensive. No, I am asking you to explore the idea. Could you just talk about it for 2 minutes?
Yeah.
You don't even have to spend hours. Could you just validate that someone had the courage to come up with a new idea and explore it for the duration of an elevator ride?
Yeah.
You don't have to implement it. But unless you explore those ideas as they're put to you, you're not going to find the 20 mediocre ideas and through exploration unearth the one of those which actually has a lot more merit than you initially assumed.
There's a psychological safety piece here as well,
yes.
Isn't there? As your conversational turn taking and no fear in relation to, yeah. I'm going to say something now,
yeah.
And I will not be judged on it.
Right.
Did you have a look at that as well in relation to
I did. It actually, a big part of this theme I discovered when I was looking at a different creative medium. I was looking at writing, and I thought, well, what's the most kind of...
Oh, that's a neat segue. I was about to go on to writing. I see what you did there. Let's go on to the realm of writing.
Boom. Well, let's do that.
I know.
And I thought, what kind of creative writing is the most pressured? Because,
yes.
You know, that's what often leaders will tell me. Sure, it's fine to be creative, but we're under so much pressure,
right.
Under resources, time.
Got
to get it done, right? Well, I thought then definitely TV sitcom writing is probably the most creative writing pressured situation you could possibly be in.
Yes.
Particularly in the U.S., because a typical sitcom season is 24 episodes.
In
the U.K., it's about 6
right.
Episodes
in
a season.
That?
So that takes place, that's over a number of months, right?
Okay.
So we're talking from September until April.
So it's a lot,
yeah,
isn't
it's
it?
A lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot. And we might assume in a 24-episode season, then when the season begins, the writers must have written all those episodes, because often that's what happens in the U.K. when
right.
It's only 6 episodes. Well, they don't. You know, a typical U.S. sitcom writing team will probably only have completely written the first 2 episodes. So they start filming episode 1, and there are 22 episodes that haven't even been written yet.
It's like improv again.
It's like improv. And they are typically filming every week with one hiatus at about mid-season.
Right.
So as they're filming 1, the writers have to immediately start refining the next week's episode and doing creating the plot and creating the major beats for the next episode.
And thinking how this is going to play out weeks and months later.
Yeah.
Right. Gotcha.
So the main point I want to make here is it's hugely pressured. And yet, they're able to be extremely creative. So the next question I ask is, what is a hugely successful U.S. TV sitcom?
I know what you're going to say.
Well, for my money, being of a certain Generation X, it was Friends, right? It was the kind of the...
Oh, let's be honest. We've grown up watching it, haven't we?
Yes, yes. We did. So I managed to speak to one of the executive producers of that show. Executive producer on a TV sitcom also means you're one of the head writers,
okay.
Also sometimes known as showrunner. So
right.
You're responsible basically for the creative output. you know, of if it's funny, if it's
pressure's on,
right? You run the writing team.
Yeah.
And this gentleman, Andrew Reich, ran a team of 12, which is actually higher than it even is now in the U.S. But he had a team of 12. So typically you had about four people working on each episode. This week's episode is next week's episode and the week after that.
Right.
And so going back to this point around failure and fear of failure, he gave me this ratio of 20 mediocre ideas for every one good idea. What he found over years writing on Friends
yes.
is that his writing team typically had to come up with 20 ideas for one idea to make it into an episode of Friends.
Wow.
20 to 1. So his goal was not pressuring his people to come up with brilliant ideas. You know, you will sit there and give me the best possible idea, otherwise shut up. No, give me as many ideas as possible. So he had a lot of techniques, and this goes back to my point around the habits, the micro habits any leader can do in any industry,
right
to improve the creative capacity, is encourage a variety and number of ideas. So Andrew did a few things. One thing he did is he role modeled vulnerability. He would intentionally do a couple things. He would not be the first person to suggest an idea in the room. Because why? If the senior most person in the room, right, the hippo, the highest paid person's opinion.
The hippo, I love it. I'm having that.
You could have that. If the hippo is the first person to suggest a new idea,
yep.
all the juniors in the room will go, oh, yes, boss, that's a brilliant idea. Or even if they will think, all they'll do thereafter is try to yes and that idea.
Right.
Well, because clearly the leader said that's the best idea. You know, that's his or her idea.
Well, now you're getting some form of echo chamber.
Yeah, exactly. So he knew he should never be the first person. In fact, he should generally be the last voice.
You know, I say that to leaders. I say on many, you know, when you're running a meeting, I say, you're the first person or the last person to talk. And let's be honest, most say, oh, well, I'm the first to talk. I might.
That's right. And it's also disheartening. Imagine sitting in a meeting in a business environment. Like, I want everyone's best ideas for how we're going to improve growth by 5%. Here's my idea. Oh, my God. You know, I mean, come on.
So he says nothing.
He says nothing.
Gotcha.
First, right? He gets other people's ideas.
Okay.
When he does suggest ideas, when he's the last person in the room to suggest idea, he would often intentionally suggest a bad idea, an idea he knew was crap, so that he could look up, blink a few times, and go, oh, you know, actually, that's a terrible idea. Why? Because he's given everyone permission.
So it's acceptance of.
Yeah.
Be bad.
We know it's going to be bad.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
But we know, and he would tell people, he would make the ratio, the 20-to-1 ratio, explicit.
Yeah.
You know, someone would say something and he would suggest an idea. He would say, keep going. I want 19 more ideas. And then we'll figure out which one's the best.
I love that. 20-to-1.
20-to-1.
Okay. Wow. Yeah.
Of course, he also discovered that sometimes people get fixated on a solution, even if it doesn't come from the hippo, right? And everyone keeps trying to yank on the door. He gives this metaphor of, imagine you're in a corridor filled with, you know, like a Scooby-Doo corridor with 12 doors on either side. If you can open any one of those, you've cracked the problem. But they're all locked. So how do you open the door?
Yeah.
Often what a team does is they pick a door and they just keep yanking on it. And they just keep trying to pick the lock. And they just keep fixating on it. Everyone just gets obsessed on piling in on that one door. In other words, that one solution.
Right.
So another thing Andrew said his job was to go, wait a minute. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, how about this door over here? Let's just leave that for now. Clearly, it's not a door that opens easily. I'm not saying it might not ultimately be the right solution. Let's just go over here. Let's just try this door for a while. Maybe it will open very easily and we'll discover the brilliance therein. So, you know, what he said, the one sentence summary of that is, stop yanking on the door if it won't open, which I think is great because I see that happening all the time. Everyone spends an inordinate amount of time in a board meeting, in an exco meeting, assuming they have the solution. All we're doing now is tweaking. Well, wait, maybe the entire solution we're discussing is wrong.
Which is why perhaps productivity is not quite where it should be if we're pulling
That's right.
at the wrong door.
And why often new products
yep.
look simply like tiny variations of existing products instead of wholly new, industry-shaking new ideas.
Well, if you think about it, we're still using... I think about Apple, for instance. I suppose that's... minor iterations on something which was a game changer right from the word go. So maybe there's a balance, isn't there, between Game changer, iteration, game changer, iteration. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
I'm not saying there's no value in iterating, but I think you also then need to be explicit with your team if you're the leader about whether we're trying to do exponential or whether we're trying to do marginal.
Yes. Okay, gotcha. It's amazing you got an opportunity to talk to the writer of Friends. I mean, let's be honest, that's absolutely iconic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Let me take you to another area, which is interesting. Culinary arts.
Yes.
How on earth did you end up here?
I'm a foodie.
Okay, there you go.
I'm definitely not a hoarder.
Right.
But I collect one thing in my life.
Yes.
And it's cookbooks.
Okay.
Right.
Are you a good cook?
I'm an okay cook, yeah. I try hard.
Right.
Yeah. I'm also the guy when planning a holiday, one of the first things I look at is, well, what are the good restaurants in this
city? Are you a food snob?
No.
I'm not sure what that means.
Well, I'll make an assumption about what you mean by that, and I'm just as happy going to a great, street food stand.
Gotcha.
As a Michelin star restaurant.
What are you looking for in food then?
I'm looking for either a new tastes I haven't tried before,
right.
new combinations, that will tickle or surprise my palate, or the very best manifestation of a flavor or a dish or a classic.
Gotcha.
If you're in Naples, you got to try the pizza, right? you're not always looking for innovation because you want to have that touchstone then in your sense memory of, well, what is the best possible pizza? So then I can assess every pizza thereafter against that.
Gotcha. Okay. So now I understand why you headed towards culinary arts.
Yes.
So what did you discover?
What I discovered was really interesting because I looked at, again, highly successful chefs in a number of different fields. Michelin star chefs.
Yes.
Celebrity chefs.
Right.
And what I found is, because that, again, huge creative pressure, right? Your clientele are always asking, what's the new dish?
Right.
Right. What's the, for, autumn season, what's going to be the new menu, et cetera. Huge pressure. Because also, just like in Friends, you always got to keep doing the status quo. Your staff have to keep putting out dish after dish after dish every night.
Yes.
To the highest quality while you're trying to invent what you're going to be doing next.
Gotcha.
And so I found among chefs, they do one of three things related to creating new dishes, new menus, et cetera. And I call it small C, medium C, big C creativity. Because, and that the small to big C is a function of the investment of time or energy required to invent. And I think probably also small C, smallest investment of time, also means the improvements or inventions are perhaps more modest some of the time, not
right.
all the time.
Okay.
Whereas big C would be the most dramatic. Okay. Small C, what I learned, I talked to a gentleman named Bobby Chin. Bobby Chin is a fascinating chef. First, he has a fascinating heritage. And this is important when I explain how he invents. His background is American, British, Egyptian, and Chinese is his heritage.
Wow. Okay.
He was the first executive chef who created the menu at House of Ho here in London,
right.
which is a Vietnamese kind of east-west restaurant. He has a restaurant called Restaurant Bobby Chin in Hanoi, Vietnam. And he is a judge on Top Chef Middle East because he's a fluent Arabic speaker.
Wow.
And he says that what he does is he categorizes in his head different kind of families of flavors. So he has like all the French mother sauces, bechamel, tomato, et cetera, right? Mornay. And then on the other side, he has like Eastern ingredients, mangosteen, lychee, wasabi, et cetera. And then he thinks, tries to make connections. What if I take someone from that family and marry them to someone from that family? And that's how he invents new dishes, right? He tries to create marriages of flavors that never existed before. And I have one recipe in the book, because I've always said to myself, I'm going to write books because I'm a foodie. I want to have a recipe in a book.
Put one in the book.
I have one in the book.
Go on.
And this comes from it was inspired by Bobby, but the recipe is mine.
Yeah.
It's for wasabi mashed potatoes.
Oh, I would like that.
It's delicious. I got to say.
Oh, I'm going to hold you to that.
Really
I want
tasty.
Some. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you think about it, right? You've got creamy, sultry, comforting mashed potatoes, cream and butter, all that starch. But it's very kind of one note. We love it because it's very comforting. It's very starchy. So how do you make it zing? How do you make it exciting? Wasabi, right? It's got a bit of sourness to it, but of course it's got that sharp heat to it.
Yes.
And it's kind of more interesting to a Western palate than just horseradish, for example.
Or mustard.
Or something like that. So that's an example. So that's small C creativity. And he does that all the time with different ingredients
okay.
and techniques. And that's how he trains his own chefs in his different kitchens, right? He says, like, let me teach you the French mother sauces. Let's explore what all these ingredients are from Vietnam, China, Japan.
And then play. Okay.
But he said, but first you have to master the basics. Then it's easier to relax and play into it. Middle C, yes. Creativity. And this comes from a chef named Ferran Adrià. And Ferran Adrià was the chef of El Bulli in Rosas, Spain, which for 5 years in a row was ranked the number one restaurant in the world.
Wow.
The restaurant is closed now.
Oh.
Because, not because it wasn't successful, but because it took so much out of him and his crew. And you see that a lot, actually, of burnout in
chefs.
Right,
so just exhausted.
Just can't do it this anymore, yeah. Oh. 5 years, and that's unprecedented. This has never happened before, right? Of top, best restaurant in the world, 5 years running. And what Ferran did is El Bulli was open only 6 months out of the year. Because he knew for the other 6 months, he had to create a new menu, and it would take that long.
Wow.
So middle C creativity is creating time and space, a lab, if you will, for creating new dishes, new menus. So this goes back to what I learned from neuroscience, devote some time and space to it.
Yes.
So he, in addition to his kitchen, he had a lab. And the lab was, you know, looking at molecules, compounds, flavors, essences, distillations, and playing around with it in order to create the new menu. He just knew you couldn't cook, and they did something like 24 courses in a tasting menu at El Bulli. You couldn't do that with like 100 guests every night and invent next year's menu. So 6 months on, 6 months off. Example, a lot of listeners will be familiar with who does this almost the same thing as Heston Blumenthal,
right.
The Fat Duck in Bray and Dinner here in London. He has a lab in Bray. Now, he doesn't close the Fat Duck, but he has dedicated staff who just work in the laboratory to create new dishes.
A dedicated team.
Just dedicated to that.
Gotcha.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And Ferran Adrià did come up with some amazing things. We sometimes take for granted in very kind of chefy places the ingredient of foam, right? We all know foam, right? Why is there all of a sudden like this sea spray scattered across my plate, decorating my scallops? We didn't have foam, right? You know, 25 years ago.
Right.
Ferran Adrià invented foam, essentially, right? He added glycerin or gelatin to a liquid. And so it's not creamy. It's very airy and light, you know, just disappears on the tongue, but has a flavor.
Okay.
So that's an example of something that came out of his lab. Okay, big C creativity.
Big C
creativity is if you really want to completely invent the new, completely kind of shock your customers or your team or your industry, is you might have to consider personal reinvention. If we go back to our earlier point that leaders often get in the way of their teams or their organization's creativity because they haven't questioned their own assumptions about what it means to lead or what their vision is for their organization, you have to start with yourself. And a great example of this from the culinary world is Chef Alain Passard of the 3-Michelin-starred Arpège restaurant in Paris. I was very fortunate to be able to finally go there and dine there this last summer after writing about it. And Alain Passard was the king of meat. He had 3 Michelin stars since the 1980s, right? Any animal protein you name, he was the master of it. That's why you went to his restaurant. But of course, in France at that time in the 80s and 90s, that was French cuisine. It was all about different meats and fish preparations.
Right.
He did some ridiculous meat preparations. He took half a chicken and half a duck, and he sewed them together, and he called it this like Frankenstein chicken duck. Now, I don't know if that's what I would particularly want to eat.
It's all the rage.
It's all the rage.
Christmas time, isn't it?
Or... I've seen pictures of it. It kind of looks icky. But I imagine it tastes delicious. But after a while, you know, not a few months, after a couple of decades, he realized he was burning out.
Okay.
You know, he had no more new ideas. All he was doing was rehashing. And he thought, you know what? I'm exhausted. No more ideas. He went on a sabbatical for a year. And he didn't know if he was going to come back to Arpège. And as he was on his retreat, he said, okay, it can't be fish and meat anymore. But that is what cuisine and French cuisine specifically is. What am I going to do? And it took him a long time. And one thing he did during his sabbatical was he gardened. And as he was gardening, he discovered vegetables. Now you might think, oh, Adam, of course he used vegetables before. Yeah, but only as like the side act.
Right.
You know, the garnish. He said, wait a minute, I can braise a piece of celery like a fillet of turbot. I could smoke a beetroot like a pigeon. I could make.
I've never heard that phrase before on this podcast.
Never said before.
Never said before in this studio.
This has never been said before in the English language. I could make the vegetable the star. Can you imagine being the king of animal protein, all of a sudden going to be, say, I'm going to be the king of vegetables. I'm going to have a vegetarian menu.
Right.
People will only come to my restaurant to eat fruit and vegetable. And everyone was shocked.
That There's is a reinvention.
Yeah, complete reinvention. They're saying, you're going to lose all your customers. No one's going to come. French like a bit of duck, a piece of fish. It's moved on since this time I described. Right. Nevertheless, he was so sure that he had to do this for his own sanity, energy, etc. He even went before the next Michelin guide ratings came out. He went to the Michelin office,
yes,
found the culinary director, and he said, Monsieur, this is what I'm doing. I have made my choice. You must make yours. That's insane bravery, right? He marched in. He's like, you don't have to discover this. I'm telling you what I'm doing. And everyone thought, oh, he's going to lose all his stars. This is it. Goodbye, you know, who used to be one of the world's most successful chefs. Well, the Michelin guide came out the next year. He kept all three of his Michelin stars, and he continues to retain all three of his Michelin stars.
Wow.
And he is still one of the most celebrated chefs. Now, actually, he's altered his menu, you know, over the years. He has, like, one fish dish on his menu. He has one meat dish on his menu. So he's scaled back from complete vegetarian cuisine, but it is still mainly a vegetarian menu. But he would say, I would not have been able to do that unless I gave myself a moment to say, maybe the issue, the block is me.
Right.
It's not my kitchen staff. It's not my chefs. It's not my waiters. It's not my clientele. It's me.
That's so relevant to leadership, yeah, isn't it? It really is. I want to ask you another one, and let's dive into the realm of art and imagery.
Yes. So I really wanted to look at this because, you know, we probably intuitively know that imagery and art can be powerful, but we don't see it very much, right? How do we communicate in corporate life? The memo, the email, the report. It's all text-based. If we're lucky, there's a graph, but you know.
Or unlucky.
Yeah, or unlucky, you know. But it really doesn't stir the blood, does it? Well, what I learned is that the human brain processes images 60,000 times faster than text. Written language.
Picture paints 1,000 words,
Picture
right?
paints 1,000 words, or in this case, 60,000 words. So there must be a huge power in that, right? You know, we know if you see a painting that deeply moves you, you know, it probably only took a second for it to do that.
Mm.
Whereas there's no way an email, even from the CEO, is going to be able to do it with that level of significance and in that short an amount of time.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. You just leaders need to think more about art and imagery for leading change, for helping people to be more adaptable, etc. What I found were a couple of really interesting examples, particularly around leading change and using art. So there's one example, a gentleman that I interviewed is named Peter Moulin-Ferouz, and he's a gentleman based in France, and he's a painter. His work is displayed in galleries, you know, very successful artist. But he also does corporate workshops. So I thought, perfect, this is the hybrid that I've been looking for. And he often talks about how do we lead change. Well, again, it starts with yourself. So he talks about one exercise where he has a group of very senior executives in the room, and he puts a cup, just a plain cup, on the table. And he said, I'd like everyone to sketch the cup. So everyone just sketches the cup.
Right.
And then he says, okay, now I'd like you to compose a poem about the cup, looking at just your painting rather than the cup, as if it came from the voice of a six-year-old. Everyone tries very hard.
That sounds like a ChatGPT prompt.
Yeah, exactly. Then he says, okay, now draw the cup again through the lens of the poem you've just created, etc. Now, at this point, he said, what often happens is one or two of these CEOs, senior executives, I can't do that. Oh, this is ridiculous. What is the point of this? Ha, pia, pa, right? And he said, actually, all these things I'm asking you to do is not to enhance your drawing ability per se. It's forcing you to confront where you get in your own way in terms of exploring the new, the novel,
right,
new habits, etc. So he said, you know, how would you talk about the cup, right, if you want someone to embrace the cup? Well, that's actually, these are the habits of how you lead people from A to B, to explore new realities, to explore something through someone else's lens, i.e. the poem.
Right.
What's interesting, he said, he gave one example of someone who was so furious, they left the room. I'm done. No way am I going to be here anyway. And he left. Months later, I think it was a full year later, he got a letter from the same executive saying, First, I'm very, very sorry for what I did.
I apologize for my behavior.
And he said, you know what? I didn't tell you, I snuck back in the room after the workshop was over when everyone was gone, and I took the cup. And the cup sits on my mantelpiece.
Really?
As a reminder to me to be open to new thoughts, new ideas, and new habits.
Oh, how funny.
Which was interesting, isn't it? You know?
Wow.
And another really quick story is that a story of an HR, a top HR team in a mining and metals company. They were going through a huge change initiative, and there were lots of layoffs, and everyone was very disheartened. And obviously, you know, we often blame HR when there are changes in human resources. But of course, it's really hard for them as well, let's be honest, right, to have to go through this. And so the senior HR team were incredibly demotivated and unengaged. And the head of that team said, when they all got back together, to say, you know what, before we talk about where we've been and where we're going, let's try to draw it together. Took out a long roll of butcher paper. Let's draw on one half of the page where we are now, and let's draw on the other half where we are going to be.
You get two orders,
basically. One is you have to do it together, everyone drawing at the same time. So you have to organically compose the picture.
Right.
Everyone drawing. So you have to figure out what's emerging here. Two is you can't talk.
Okay.
And one of the gentlemen in that team who I interviewed said it was profound how quickly we unearthed ideas that either we were too embarrassed or concerned to talk about. That was evident in the painting. And two is it unearthed some subconscious things. Things we wouldn't, if we had the conversation, we wouldn't have gotten there because we didn't even know that was going on.
There's almost space to just let it out.
Just let it all out, yeah. Wow. And he said, we probably saved months, literally months, in having a common context of where we are and commitment about where we're going through doing that exercise. Now, yes, after you do the exercise, you talk about it. Of course you do. But it really speaks to the power of art. So the last point I'll make, going back to this, the importance of imagery, comes from an example from the COO of Suntory Europe. A lot of listeners will be familiar with Suntory. They do alcoholic and non-alcoholic drinks. If you've ever seen the classic film Lost in Translation. For relaxing times, make it Suntory time.
Oh, look at you. You went all movie on me just then.
I went all Bill Murray there, just for a second. So they went through this intense, a number of mid to senior level leaders went through an intense leadership development program with me. And they said, we have a global leadership conference coming up in Tokyo at the beginning of the year. How do we help tell people everything that's happened? Well, the obvious thing is, one of us should get butt into the agenda and ask for 15 minutes to summarize what we've done. And I thought, well, is that actually going to make any difference? Are you going to positively infect everyone else with all the... No, probably not. So one of the themes they talked about is we have to cut bureaucracy, right, in order to be more creative and inventive.
Yeah.
And so how do we do that? So what they said is, let's look at art and imagery. They said, why don't we all have a lapel pin that just has a powerful image on it? We're not going to ask for a moment in the agenda of the conference to talk about it, but if the hundreds of global executives see, you know, a couple dozen people wandering around all with the same lapel pin, they're going to go,
curiosity,
can I just ask,
in.
Yeah, what is that? You know, you've already forgotten what someone just talked about on stage, but you don't forget, everywhere I look, I'm seeing this pin.
Yeah.
The pin that they agreed on was in the form of a katana, which is a samurai sword, right?
Yes.
The weapon of the ancient samurai. Because this idea of let's cut bureaucracy, let's cut red tape, let's cut old habits in order to explore, right? So that was the main message they wanted to deliver. But they knew that they would be able to create that positive infection faster through lots of little intimate one-on-one conversations throughout the week of the Global Leadership Conference. So it just started with an image, katana on a lapel pin.
And then curiosity kicked in.
And they said all these, you know, having dozens and dozens of one-on-one conversations was infinitely more powerful than one person standing up at the podium and going, this is what we discovered, blah, blah, blah. 99%
of organizations will still do.
Will still do.
Are you finding you're using some of this in the work that you're now doing with leaders and organizations? Are you embracing and taking this with you?
Yeah, they are. But I think it starts with the idea of, is it possible? You know, I think we have to, people have to uncover or rediscover some natural human capabilities, mainly humility. I don't necessarily have to have the right idea. And curiosity, to our earlier point.
Which are two of the components out of my eight components of human-centered leadership, just saying.
Exactly.
So that's a good sign.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, what would you say would be the two main takeaways for leaders, possibly an unfair question for you, out of all of this work and research? What would you say?
I think that's very fair. One I've sort of alluded to, and that is, for example, when you're trying to think of new ideas to problems or opportunities, please, in your conversations with your team, separate out the three tasks that inevitably are going to be involved. And the three tasks are ideation, evaluation, and selection.
Right.
Generally, though, in a typical brainstorming meeting that doesn't have any creative discipline, all of those get jumbled together, right? Someone throws out an idea. Someone else goes, this is why that idea won't work. Someone else throws out an idea. And someone goes, okay, we're going to do that. And everyone immediately starts yanking on that door and trying to implement
So go through that. So it's ideation.
Ideation, evaluation, selection, right?
Gotcha.
Just get all the ideas on the page. Ideation. Don't judge anything. Let's just get out every idea we have. Free flowing.
Gotcha.
Then, okay, we're drawing a line, and now we're going to look at which of these ideas might have some legs. And you explore, and you yes and the ideas. Going to my early point, you have to uncover what are the good ideas. You shouldn't assume an idea that at face value looks poor. Ed Catmull, the MD of Pixar, once said, every initial script I read is crap. It's only through iteration that we get these.
It turns into the blockbuster.
It turns into the blockbuster.
Gotcha. Okay. No, I love that.
And then you select under whatever criteria you're using.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's the first. That's the first one.
The second is make it real as soon as possible. As soon as you select the idea, don't make this a huge project involving millions of pounds, hundreds of person hours, etc. And it starts to feel like a poorly engineered military campaign from a third world dictatorship, instead of, let's just prototype it, you know? Can we just quickly...
Fast failure.
Can we just make something out of tape and cardboard and saliva? Or, you know, and just play with it for a bit?
Yeah. It's where design thinking comes in as well, doesn't it?
Completely.
Some of this. What's next for you?
Well, I want to spread the good word about this book, right? It only came out a few months ago, and what I really want to do is try to make this a movement, if I could be so bold.
Okay. Well, you're passionate about this, aren't you?
I'm really passionate about this, because I do think that it is a huge gap in corporate life, but I do think there's a desire, but people don't know what to do about it. I could have explored the macro themes, which are perfectly valid, of what do you do in terms of incentivization and organizational design and systems and processes.
This sounds more fun.
But I want to do more fun stuff. I also want something, you know, and every chapter ends with this phrase, something you can do on Monday morning.
So very practical.
The habits. I really want to focus on conversations and relationships so that anyone could read the book or have you know, through consultation with me or whatnot and go, okay, I know at least a few things I can try immediately without requiring resources.
So I'm assuming available on Amazon and all good bookstores.
Exactly. Yes.
Which is obvious, isn't it? How do people get in touch with you, Adam, to have the conversation and take it further?
Yeah, I've got a website, adamkingle.com. It contains information about my books, podcasts, articles.
Like this
webinars,
one.
Like this one. And there's a page where you can contact
me. I like your website, actually. I've seen that. It's very good. I'll put it into the show notes.
Thank
so
you.
That people have got that. And maybe I'll put the Amazon link in there as well.
Great.
So people have got that too. Listen, I always love talking to you. You're a superstar for coming back. Actually, it's three times. We can't tell them what happened to the last. You said the digital homework was eaten by the dog.
Yes.
But no, thanks so much for taking the time to come back in.
Of course.
And come back to us again when you've written your next book.
Oh, of course I will.
Because you know you'll end up writing another book,
you? I'm sure I probably
it's just
will.
The way it is, but it's brilliant. No, listen, thanks very much for coming back to the Enigma. Really appreciate it. Take great care.
Thanks so much.
Thanks. Join us again next week for more curiosity and insight with the Leadership Enigma. We'd love to hear your comments on today's show, as well as suggestions for future topics and guests. Get in touch with me on LinkedIn or visit us at www.leadersenigma.com. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on all your major podcast platforms and on our dedicated YouTube channel. Thanks again for joining the community.